Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast for the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. Today, my guest is former NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. Jim served as the 13th Administrator of NASA, where he was responsible for managing NASA's 70,000 person workforce and $23 billion annual budget. Under his leadership, NASA reestablished an American human spaceflight program, which had been lost after the retirement of the space shuttles in 2011. He created NASA's Artemis program to establish the first permanent presence on the moon with commercial and international partners. Before being appointed as the NASA administrator, Jim served in the United States House of Representatives from Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District from 2013 to 2018. He was a member of the House Armed Services Committee and the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, where he chaired the Subcommittee on the Environment and introduced the Space Renaissance Act. Prior to Congress, Jim served as a pilot in the United States Navy, acquiring 1,900 flight hours and 333 landings on aircraft carrier. He flew combat missions in Afghanistan and Iraq off the USS Abraham Lincoln, where he earned an Air Medal and Navy Commendation Medal for combat. Originally an E-2 Hawkeye pilot, he transitioned to the F-18 Hornet and flew an Aggressor, Red Air, at Navy Strike and Air Warfare Center, the parent command to Top Gun. Today, Jim serves on the board of directors for Viasat, the board of trustees for the Aerospace Corporation, and he chairs the board of advisors for Voyager Space. He also serves as a consultant for various other aerospace companies. Welcome, Jim.
It's great to be here, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. Well, let me start off with a first. So, how do you describe what you do and your role in the space ecosystem?
So I'm an independent consultant, and so I work with private companies, and I've got clients in different parts of, different sizes of companies, from small and newly formed companies to mature companies that are in some cases small and in some cases, prime contractors. So I consider myself an advisor to people who are looking for advice, mostly on, strategic activities that their companies are involved in related to space.
And so how do you see space as important to U.S. strategy and ambitions?
Well, there's a lot of ways. Obviously, there's the how we communicate, navigate, produce food, produce energy, do disaster relief, national security, predict weather, understand climate, remote sensing, imagery, missile warning. I mean, on the defense side of things, there's a tremendous amount of activity. On the intelligence side, with remote sensing and imagery, there's more activity. So clearly, space is very important for the United States of America. And the way I generally think of it, you divide it up into all the elements of national power. And I know your audience is largely a national security audience, so I think about it, the dime theory of national power: diplomatic power, information power, military power, economic power. And in every single one of those elements, space plays a very important role. Without question, space is critical to our very way of life in ways that most Americans don't know. And I think, people talk about how the GPS timing signal is necessary for banking transactions and the power grid and regulation of the flows of electricity on the power grid and the regulation of flows of data on wireless networks like your cell phone network. So all of these things are important to the American way of life. If we lose space, we lose the American way of life. It's really that simple. So it is a key strategic capability for the country on all of those elements of national power: diplomatic, information, military, and economic.
Now, the last time that you and I talked, you told me the story of sort of how you came into space at all upon leaving the Navy. And I just thought that was such an interesting story. Can you just sort of retell that story of the whole way in which you got to know people in the industry and then became SMART, which would later reappear in your efforts in Congress?
Oh, going back to my, so you're talking about the Rocket Racing League. Yeah. So when I was a young Navy lieutenant, getting ready to separate from the Navy, I was looking for what I might want to be interested in doing next. And I read about this organization called the Rocket Racing League in Popular Science magazine, of all things. And I wanted to see if it's real. And so think of the Rocket Racing League was it was a venture startup, needed to raise a ton of capital. But the idea was, we're going to take the business model of NASCAR, revenue streams from ticket sales, merchandising, television rights, corporate sponsors, video gaming, take all of those revenue streams, and instead of racing cars on a track, we're going to race rockets in a three-dimensional track in the sky with pilots on board the rockets. Now, this was the concept that I got enthused about back in 2003, and I reached out and I put some of my own capital into this venture startup, which ultimately never materialized, and I lost all of my money. But nonetheless, I got excited about it. And here's what I was excited about. I was excited about the prospect of advancing rocket science and space technology in the private sector, apart from the whimsical budgets of politicians. That's what I cared about. And this was on the heels of, if you remember the Ansari X Prize, when Paul Allen put up $10 million for somebody who could get into space twice in 1 week. It was one with Spaceship One, and somebody claimed a $10 million prize, but they put $25 million into creating or into building Spaceship One. And then, of course, Sir Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic, bought the rights to, that technology and created what is now Virgin Galactic, and we're seeing those activities. So on the heels of the Ansari X Prize, which was this thing that came into being back in the very early 2000s, the idea was, how do we continue that enthusiasm? How do we make sure that there are prizes for the advancements of these technologies and apply a racing theme so that we'd have constant revenue streams? And here's the other thing that I liked about it. The rockets were, there was no modulation of throttle. So the vehicle itself, think of a, so it's a velocity aircraft, which is modeled after a Burt Rutan designed long easy. So it's an all composite vehicle, aft wing, forward canard. And instead of a push prop, you remove the push prop and you put on a rocket motor. And like I said, there's no modulation of throttle. So your rocket is either on or it's off. What does that mean? That means that who wins and loses the race is not based on who's got the fastest rocket, because the rockets are largely going to be the same. They will be the same design. It's a matter of who can best manage the energy state of the vehicle during the course of the race in a three-dimensional track in the sky. So when do you thrust? When do you glide? And everybody's flying in what we call a racetrack in the sky. So projected in your helmet visor are a series of rings that you're flying through. So one person's flying through circles, another person's flying through squares, another person's flying through pentagons. It's all projected in your helmet visor. And that enables you to maintain close proximity yet safe separation, which I was, this helmet-mounted virtual display stuff was kind of early days back then. So I thought that was pretty exciting. How do we take these military technologies, transfer them to the private sector? But also, what we present in our helmet visors would also be available on a television screen. So somebody watching at home, you've watched pro baseball, and you can see when they put that strike box right over the home plate there, so you can see whether or not a pitch is a strike or a ball. Well, we would project what I can see in my helmet visor as a 3D racetrack in the sky. We would project those rings on the screen so that people can see us flying through those rings, just like you see a baseball flying through the strike zone on a pro baseball game. So the other thing is, you take all of this data. So our vehicles are going to have, GPS, smooth, or I guess it would be an inertial navigation system, smooth with GPS. And so you take this data, latitude, longitude, altitude, yaw pitch, roll, trajectory, velocity, all of this data, you teleport it off your vehicle, and you can create a digital image of what we're doing in the race, you can create a digital image in real time of what we're doing. What that gives you so many different opportunities. Now, all of a sudden, instead of, let's say I get a sponsorship from Kellogg's, I could be in one frame, I could be Frosted Flakes, and another frame, I could be Special K, and another frame, I could be Rice Krispies. You can now, instead of putting, you know, dozens of stickers on your car that nobody can see at 180 miles an hour, now you can time divide how you're branding your sponsor. So you can sell, you know, 5 seconds or 10 seconds or, and all of a sudden your brand is visible instead of being a small sticker blazing by at 180 miles an hour. So once you can create that digital image, not only is your branding time divided, but now I can have kids on the other side of the planet racing against me real time when I'm in a real race. So this is this live and virtual and constructive all coming together. Again, the idea, get more young people enthusiastic about these new technologies like rocket technology and composite technology and avionics technology. And so there's a lot of opportunity there. And then I also saw, like I was talking about the racetrack in the sky, one person flying through circles, another person flying through squares. There's no reason those have to be circles or squares. You can make it the McDonald's arches, for example, or you could make it a Burger King logo. The amount of branding opportunity here, I think, was really immense. So I got excited about the idea of advancing rocket science and space technology in the private sector, apart from the whimsical budgets of politicians. And I believed in that as something that we needed to do as a country. I got excited about it as a young Navy pilot. They needed to raise hundreds of millions, if not more, dollars, and they never quite raised enough, and eventually they folded. In the meantime, I got really excited about these things, and while the goal was to advance rocket science and space technology apart from the whimsical budgets of politicians, I eventually decided I just need to become a politician myself. as terrible
and you
as
were
that
able
sounds.
To keep that pro-industry, pro-STEM, you know, excitement through. And, you know, I mean, we should probably talk about, you know, some of the things, you know, that you were able to do in terms of continuing to advance COTS and commercial crew and, you know, CLIPS and what you tried to do to establish precedents for purchasing things and just the whole viewpoint of space industrialization. So let's just go from there. Talk to me about, like, how did this manifest?
So again, that was back in 2002, 2003, that time frame. Moving forward, I got elected to Congress in 2012, and by this time you had commercial resupply already resupplying the International Space Station with a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and a Dragon capsule, even though it wasn't a crewed capsule. So that had already kind of that had already presented itself as a great opportunity. And of course, we wanted to take that model and apply it going forward. Again, the challenge in the space world historically is it is a zero-sum game. The government is the owner and operator of all the systems. And if that's the case, you're gonna have a budget, and that budget is gonna get divided among the different players. And if one player gets more money, another player has their money taken away. And that becomes very political and very cantankerous. And it's not the environment that fosters the type of innovation that our country needs, primarily because the people who are legacy, who have the big contracts and all the big lobbyists, they're going to maintain their positions and there's no opportunity for innovation. So as much as possible, in my view, and this was my position in Congress, as well as when I went to NASA, as much as possible, we needed to end the zero-sum game mindset and say, what could we do if this was commercialized? How do we raise capital from the private sector that the public sector can benefit from? How do we get customers that are not the US government? And if we can create market opportunities where we have numerous providers that are selling services or data to the government. That's the key, services or data, but not the government isn't owning and operating systems. the numerous providers that are selling services or data to the government. The government is one customer of many customers, and there's numerous providers competing against each other on cost and innovation. That's how you create this virtuous cycle of innovation that sets the United States of America apart from every other country on the planet. So that's the virtuous cycle that we have to create. And so, you know, I proposed legislation when I was in Congress to move things that direction. When I got to be the NASA administrator, my first major initiative was the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program. China was going to the moon. If they're going to be on the moon tomorrow, how do we get to the moon today? And that was, of course, uncrewed, no humans involved. And so I said, we can take a lot of risk. What I really wanted to do is, this was at the end of the, if you remember the Google Lunar X Prize, not the Ansari X Prize, but the Google Lunar X Prize, it had ended and nobody won it. And so I said, these are companies that have moved forward already. Let's have NASA reestablish that prize and keep these companies moving forward. Well, legally, talking to the attorneys at NASA, there was no way for us to legally create a prize. But what we could do is we could take payloads that NASA wants to see on the surface of the moon, and we could have people compete to take our payloads to the surface of the moon. And so that's what formed this Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program. To be really clear, Peter, and I think of all people, you know this, that program was designed with venture capital in mind. In other words, we're gonna put money on a number of different companies, knowing that there's gonna be failure along the way. We're gonna accept the failure because we're putting in not a whole lot of money, but if one of them is successful, the returns will be very significant. That's the intent. And so we have seen now Astrobotic with the Peregrine lander. They lost it. That is not optimum, but it's not a terrible surprise. And when we rolled this out, we told everybody, look, we're probably going to see some burning holes in the moon, and we're okay with that because we're going fast and we're going to innovate. And by going fast, what that means is we're going to establish parameters that allow people to fail fast, learn, and move forward again. And by the way, we're taking this kind of philosophy, these models, from SpaceX, quite frankly, that has been doing this all along the way. The U.S. government can learn a lot from innovative commercial companies. And so anyway, that's what the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program was about. But CLPS, as we call it, was one. The human landing system for the moon was another. Commercial LEO destinations was another. All of these different programs. So that's how we're going to replace the International Space Station in low Earth orbit. Commercial lunar or commercial LEO destinations. So we're going to have numerous commercial space stations that are not owned and operated by the government, but capitalized privately, that the government can be a customer of. And when we do this, we will see tremendous amounts of innovation. The cost will go down and access to space will go up.
So that's a great segue. So I remember reading, and I'll post it in the show notes, you gave a terrific speech way back, and I want to say like 2015, 2016, called This Is Our Sputnik Moment. And you laid out this vast, expansive vision for cislunar. So what I'd really like to do is to go to first principles as broad and as far reaching as you want. Like, where do you want to take American space? Paint me a future of our vision in space going forward.
So this is, it's a frontier, right? And the United States of America has a long history in the frontier. And it's not necessarily a space frontier. Our frontier was from the East Coast to the West Coast. And what took us to the West Coast? All of those things that led America west, eventually, we think about the gold rush, for example, and we think about the discovery of oil in Oklahoma and, you know, all these different types of things that moved us west and then back to Oklahoma. And of course, Oklahoma is my home state. So the question is, what's going to move us outward? And, you know, if history is the lesson, then it's going to be, you know, economic activity that expands us outward. So we think about what is the economic activity in space. And of course, we've already touched on a lot of it. We talked about the value of space to improve life on Earth, navigation, communication, remote sensing, imagery, prediction of weather, understanding climate, producing of food, energy, you know, all of these things that we've discussed and how important it is to banking and all the things that affect our lives from the power grid to wireless networks. So all of that, we know full well the value of space today, that when you think about the 1960s, or think about when John F. Kennedy went to the Congress in 1961 and said, we're going to send a man to the moon and bring him safely back to the Earth. How crazy that was in 1961, after Alan Shepard, just a few weeks prior, had gone up 100 miles and come back down. So you think about, we didn't know what space was going to offer humanity. Now we know, and we look back and we think, my goodness, we're grateful for a nation that was willing to take these massive steps to achieve these accomplishments, because look at how humanity has benefited from it. Well, the moon is, I think, going to be the same way. Cislunar space is the same way. We think about the value of the moon right now is not well known. We do know that there is value there. We think about the Lagrangian points, where you can be balanced between the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the moon for long periods of time, and you can sustain a presence in space without having to use really any energy for long periods of time. Those are extraordinarily valuable areas of space. If for no other reason, they're valuable, you know, for national security reasons. What can be stored there? You think about not just what can be stored there, but you think about how important space is to humanity. Well, what if the enemy gets the idea to attack space from above? That is a pretty scary prospect when you consider how dependent we are on space and how little space domain awareness we have in the cislunar regime. So I think it's important for us to understand what threat nations around the world, what are their prospects for space? Where do they want to go? Why do they want to go there? And we need to be able to not only have visibility into those areas with sensors, but we also need to be able to communicate and navigate around those areas, which requires an architecture that currently doesn't exist but needs to be built quickly. And then we think about the moon itself. When we think about, I mean, there's so much science to be done in the moon. We can learn about what the early solar system was like, because the moon doesn't have an active geology or an active atmosphere, or an active hydrosphere. So the moon is like, everything on the moon is preserved. It is today right where it was billions of years ago, except for new impacts from meteorites that are hitting the moon. But we know that the moon it's a data repository of the early solar system. We know that there's impacts there that could be information that even go beyond our own solar system. So that's interesting. The challenge with the Earth is that it has this very active geology, hydrosphere, atmosphere. Nothing that, and by the way, things don't impact the Earth the way they impact the moon, because we do have these protections like the atmosphere, that everything burns up in the atmosphere. Well, at the moon, everything just hits the moon. And so there could be large deposits of platinum group metals. And we know that there's hundreds of millions of tons of water ice. Water ice represents hydrogen and oxygen, air to breathe, water to drink, hydrogen is fuel. So all of that stuff is resident at the moon. We talk about rare earth metals here on Earth. They're not earth metals on the moon. They'd be rare lunar metals, I guess. But they could be there in large deposits, because, again, the moon doesn't have an active geology. So there could be a lot of economic value to the moon that is unrealized. And I think it's important. It's important for us to at least make sure we understand what is there, so that we don't get left behind if a discovery is made.
You know, that brings up the fact that during your tenure as NASA administrator, we saw pretty major advances and budget increases in planetary defense. Do you have any thoughts on planetary defense?
I think I want to be really clear. There is nothing right now that we see from any of our telescopes that are looking into deep space that would be a threat to planet Earth. We went to Bennu, which was pretty exciting, with OSIRIS-REx. We were surprised when we landed on Bennu, which was an asteroid, oh, I guess maybe a couple of football fields big or something. We went out to this asteroid and we tried to land on it, and it turns out that it's just a really loose field of pebbles and dirt. And when OSIRIS-REx went down to try to take a scoop, it kept going in deeper and deeper into this asteroid. And all of a sudden, this big plume of debris comes out. They got OSIRIS-REx out. It grabbed a ton of material, so much material they couldn't get the clamshell closed. Eventually they got it closed and they brought the material home, and now it's safely on Earth. But what's interesting is we think about Bennu, there was a tiny, tiny chance that it could have hit the Earth, 150 or 200 years from now, something like that. But it would have never hit the Earth because it just would have burned up in the atmosphere. So it was so loosely held together. But those are the types of things that we need to do more research on. And of course, I think it's important that NASA is the one agency that can look out into the solar system and make those types of discoveries and assessments and characterizing those objects that are out there in deep space that might one day have a crossing, pattern with the Earth. I think that's important. I will also tell you, I don't think we're in any jeopardy.
So returning sort of to the big picture, what is a space agenda worthy of our nation?
So we've talked about the moon. A lot of people are familiar that I established the Artemis program at NASA. The whole purpose of the Artemis program is to go sustainably to the moon. In other words, we're going to stay. And it's open architecture. When I say open architecture, what that means is we don't want to go as the United States of America to the moon by ourselves, leave flags and footprints and come home. The goal is, how do we marshal not just the US government, but commercial industry and international partners and commercial industry within our international, how do we marshal all of this to go to the moon and go sustainably? So the idea is we want to build infrastructure. We think about the gateway in orbit around the moon. The gateway is an opportunity for people to get into cislunar space. And when I say open architecture, what I mean is how we do environmental control and life support systems, how we do data communication, how we do rendezvous and proximity operations and docking, avionics. All of these things are going to be available so that commercial companies and international partners, they too can utilize the gateway to get access to the surface of the moon. We want to build what is necessary for others to also participate in lunar activities. And this is one of the reasons we established the Artemis Accords. We want us, when people start going to the moon and they're using the architecture that the American taxpayer is investing in, we want them to follow the rules that we're establishing as a community of nations so that we're not going to interfere with each other and we're not going to ultimately do more harm than good. And so we said, look, if you want to go to the moon with us, we want you with us. We want your commercial industry to go with us. We want our own commercial industry going. But as we do this together, we want to make sure that we're doing it safely and sustainably. And that's really a fundamental element of the moon architecture. It's also true that when we go to Mars, we're going to learn how to live and work on another world for long periods of time. So we can take that knowledge to Mars. The challenge with Mars, of course, is it's on the same side of the sun as the Earth once every 26 months. So when you go to Mars, you got to be willing to stay. Of course, that can change. If we had nuclear propulsion, for example, we could actually do what's called an opposition class return mission. So when Earth and Mars are on not exactly aligned on the same side of the sun, we can still actually make it home. If we could do that, you don't have to stay on Mars for 2 years at a time. You can go for, a few days and then come back to Earth. And so the architecture for Mars is important. Investments in technology for Mars are important. But when we do it again, we want to do it as, you know, the United States of America needs to lead. We need to establish the norms that people need to abide by. And then we need to have a coalition of nations that goes with us. And if we do it right, then it's all going to work. And I think that's the key, creating the right architecture, having the right international and commercial partners, and having the right norms of behavior.
So now, you know, I remember you talking about space industrialization in the context of commercial LEO destinations. And you've talked about this open architecture and infrastructure and US industry going to the moon and potential economic returns. But, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, all the listeners would have your background talking to Paul Spoudis and the Google Lunar XPRIZE community. So can you make it a little more, you know, visual or visceral of like, what does a developed, you know, lunar industrial complex, you know, what does that look like? What's going on there? And, you know, who yeah. are the potential partners and what are they doing?
Yeah, great. All great questions. Let's start with low Earth orbit, if that's all right. So we think about the International Space Station has been an amazing tool of discovery and science and learning. And when we built the International Space Station, we don't know what we're going to learn. Here's what we now know. Pretty much every experiment that you do in microgravity results in a discovery. Every one of them. Like people say, well, we're at the tip of the iceberg. Well, actually, this is an iceberg that nobody understands. Like this is not even an iceberg. An iceberg, you know that it's ice and you're in the ocean. This is microgravity to us is so new and unusual that it results in discoveries that are transformational. And then these discoveries, the question is, can you go from basic science to applied science and from applied science to commercialization and then industrialization? That's the key. Where we are right now is we're in between like basic science and applied science. That's where we are. And we think about, for example, protein crystals. So we think about pharmaceutical crystals that have the ability to cure cancer, for example. You know, there are drugs that we have tested on the International Space Station for lung cancer. And we can create crystals that are so pure and so perfect that instead of taking 3 or 4 months to figure out if there's going to be some level of efficacy from these drugs, you're going to know within a week or two. And by the way, you don't have to administer those drugs through infusions, which are painful and take time and cost a lot of money. Now you can take those same drugs by a pill. So you're going to take a drug by a pill. You're going to know within a couple of weeks whether or not it was effective. And if it's not, you can move on to something else. But this is the type of capability that microgravity uniquely brings to the development of a pharmaceutical crystal. And by the way, I just mentioned a lung cancer. Well, there's all kinds of cancers that can be treated with all different types of crystals. You can create more pure crystals, more perfect crystals. You can also create new crystals that you can't create in the gravity well of Earth. And so the way we think about pharmaceuticals is it's going to be transformational when you think about using microgravity to create these new pharmaceuticals and new drugs. Crystals are one thing. Microbiology, biotechnology. There's all kinds of things. You know, we just printed in 3D a meniscus on the International Space Station for somebody's knee. It's not going to be implanted in somebody's knee, but we proved that we could take, Peter, we can take your skin, reverse your skin cells into stem cells. We can take those stem cells and create the material, basically cells. We can create meniscus cells. We can put those into a 3D printer and we can print your meniscus in 3D in the microgravity of space. Why is that? Because in microgravity, the strongest force is surface tension. And so we can create a meniscus using surface tension that will hold its form in 3D in microgravity. If you did it in the gravity well of Earth, it would just turn to mush. It would just turn to basically putty. But once you've got it created in space, now you can cure it. You can bring it back to Earth. It's now usable. So we're 3D printing human tissue in space. We're also growing human tissue using stem cells that come from your skin to create tissue for like veins and heart tissue and muscle tissue and skin tissue. We can create this tissue and then we can use it for regenerative medicine. Today it's tissue. Down the road, we think about what the future could hold. We could talk about creating entire organs. And here's the value of doing this. You know, today, if you do an organ transplant, you have to find a match. Hard to do. Not only do you have to find a match, now it could still be rejected by your body. So you have to take all of this anti-rejection medicine, which is also an infusion. It takes time. It costs money. But what if, and it's painful, but what if instead we could, Peter, we could take you and create an organ for you? And your body won't reject it because it is, in fact, you. You don't need to take the anti-rejection medicines. And you know that your body's going to accept it because it is you. So these are the types of regenerative medicine activities that I think are going to be transformational in space. I talked a lot when I was at NASA about, you know, creating an artificial retina for the human eyeball, something that you have to do in the microgravity of space because the material is so thin. We're talking about one or two atoms thick. And then being able to, basically, people who have macular degeneration don't have to go blind anymore. And insurance reimburses that at $50,000 to $75,000 a piece, which means the business case closes. So now people are going to want to go build a shoebox that can create 1,000 artificial retinas and take it to space. What all we have done at NASA, and there's so much more, but what we do at NASA is we do the science to see if things can be done and how they could be done. And now we're to the point where there's private companies out there generating private capital to take what we've done and commercialize it. And that's where we go from basic science to applied science to eventual commercialization. And I think for a lot of things, we're kind of between basic and applied. We're seeing some level. You look at Varda, for example, they're flying free flyers into space with HIV, brand new HIV drugs that they're creating. So that's an example of going from applied science to commercialization. They haven't proven themselves yet, but they're certainly raising a lot of money and they're flying things in space and they're bringing those things back to Earth.
So that's the model in LEO.
Yeah, so that's LEO. So then the question is, okay, what about the moon? So the challenge in LEO is you can do a lot more science a lot faster when you have humans involved. We love robots. We want to see more and more robotic activity. But if you have humans involved, you can get a lot more done a lot quicker. The challenge with humans is the physiology in space is affected by the radiation environment, the microgravity environment, all hard on the human condition. You know, you lose 1 to 3% of your bone mass every month. You lose your muscle mass. You've got to do all this stuff. And there's a lot of other problems. I mean, your immune system gets degraded significantly. You get tons of pressure built up in your head. It changes the shape of your eyeball. Sometimes you get lesions on your brain. There's all kinds of physiological problems from flying in space. Some of it is reversible. Some of it is not, depending on the astronaut and those kind of things. A lot of things are different. Well, the thing is, in Earth orbit, you're in literally microgravity, very, very tiny gravity. But when you get to the moon, you're in a gravity well that's 1/6 that of the Earth. The question is, what are the countermeasures that you get? What is the value from the countermeasures that you get from being in a 1/6 gravity well? Does the blood, maybe it doesn't rush to your head, and maybe you don't have the changes in eyesight. Maybe your immune system is not as degraded. Maybe you don't have the challenges with the brain and these other things. Maybe you don't lose your bone mass. Maybe you don't lose your muscle mass. These are all things that we don't know, but we need to go learn. And the other thing is, by definition, when you land on the moon, you've cut the radiation dose in half on the surface of the moon, because the radiation is not just coming from the sun, it's also coming from deep space. And so when you're on the surface of another planet, the radiation is only coming from above. It's not coming from below. So there you're cutting the radiation dose in half just by being on the surface. If you could get into a lava tube or some kind of cave on the moon, those exist. If you can get inside there, you can cut the radiation dose to near zero. And once your radiation dose is near zero and you're in a 1/6 gravity well, now maybe you can sustain life on another world for much longer periods of time. And if you can you, if the gravity well is 1/6 that of the Earth, does that enable you to do a lot of these transformative science capabilities that we're doing in microgravity without the harsh condition on human physiology? And if we could achieve that on the moon, that's one element of what would make the moon sustainable. So if we can create, for example, artificial retinas for the human eye or regenerative medicine kind of capabilities, if we could do that stuff on the moon, and I'm not saying we can, I don't know. It sounds very science fiction, but look, 50 years ago, the International Space Station would have sounded mind-blowingly science fiction as well. So we need to keep an open mind about how we think about these things and what the art of the possible is. If you put yourself back in the 1950s and you started talking about all the things that we're going to generate from the International Space Station, people would have thought you were crazy. And now we're well beyond that. So so we think about the moon and the value, the context thereof, and then, but it's not just the science and discovery and sustainability with human physiology. It's also, you know, what is on the moon? Are there massive deposits of platinum group metals that could be worth hundreds of billions of dollars? and can we use the regolith to create things that are of value on the surface to sustain life? Can we use the water ice for life support? So these are all, I think, things that we need to be thinking about as we push further to the moon and think about the value of cislunar space.
So you've mentioned China a couple times. Tell me a bit about where you see China's space program headed, and you know why that's something that ought to be a concern of ours, both on the civil and on the national security side.
Well, there is no doubt we have seen, and I'm not telling your audience anything they don't already know on this, but direct ascent anti-satellite missiles, co-orbital anti-satellite capabilities, terrestrial capabilities that are affecting space, like jamming and dazzling and hacking and all these different proliferated technologies. So here's what we know. We know how valuable space is to the American way of life. We also know that we need to think about China in the Taiwan context. And that's pretty much the overwhelming driving thought as far as, you know, our relations with China. They say they're going to reunite with Taiwan. They say they're going to do it by force if necessary. What are the implications for that to the United States of America from microchips, et cetera? Big deal. This is a really big deal, something that the United States of America needs to pay very strong attention to. If we get into a scenario where we're defending Taiwan, for them, it's in their backyard. For us, it's a power projection challenge. And so they're investing heavily in anti-access area denial capabilities. And we're going to have to project power on the other side of the planet, as we always do. And when you do that, you can't do it without space. China has seen how we project power in Iraq, how we project power in Afghanistan. You know, even going back to, you know, the war in Kosovo, for example, they have seen how we use space to basically benefit our troops on the ground. Space has always been used as a power projection capability, whether it's precision guided munitions or GPS or over the horizon communications or missile warning. They have seen how space is integrated into the terrestrial fight for the United States of America. In response to them seeing us use space in that way, they have responded by creating anti-space capabilities, or what we would call counter space capabilities. They know if we're going to use it, they need to wreck it. And we need to respond by saying, okay, if you're going to wreck our space capabilities, we're going to wreck your counter space capabilities. So now you've got counter space capabilities, or what we would say is defensive counter space. And so we've been living in this world of, you know, counter space on their part and defensive counter space on our part. And now we're looking at a whole new regime where China is making investments the way we have made investments. We use space to affect the terrestrial war. They have made the same investments now, whether it's over the horizon communications or remote sensing or the Beidou system for precision guided munitions, et cetera. So they have invested in space architectures that make them much better at fighting a terrestrial war, just like we have made investments in space to better fight the terrestrial war. So if they're going to get an advantage over the United States of America by using space-based capabilities to defeat our terrestrial forces, we as a country must be able to defend our terrestrial forces. And I hear people talk about frequently that, well, we don't want any kind of war in space. Nobody wants war in space. What if space is used to defeat our troops on the ground? That now we're talking about, you're willing to give up American warfighters in order to avert a war extending into space, a war that they themselves are involved in, that we are choosing not to be involved in. I think the American warfighter is way too important. The American warfighter needs to be defended and fought for. And so this changes the dynamic. And now for the first time, we're hearing General Saltzman, for example, talk about counter space capabilities being part of, you know, his strategy for how we win in space. And it's responsible counter space. I want to be really clear, responsible counter space. The United States of America is not going to create massive debris fields in space. We're not going to wreck low Earth orbit. We're not going to put our American astronauts on the International Space Station in danger. We're not going to do those things. We're going to do responsible counter space, but for the first time, we're talking about both offensive and defensive counter space as part of the American strategy. And the only reason that's happening is because we're seeing the investments that China is making. So when you think about China in this context, we think about national security, we think about Taiwan. When we think about China in the economic context, we see them building a brand new, what they call the Chinese International Space Station. They're holding conferences as to how to create new medicines using the microgravity of space. We see them having a moon program and being very clear that they're going to land on the moon by 2030. And we see them engaging in all these things. And what we see is, in each case, they're achieving their objectives methodically, step by step. And what is the United States doing? We're arguing for mission authorization, whether it should be at transportation or commerce. Like, that's what Congress is all worried about. Is it going to be transportation or commerce? And if we can't agree on that, then we're just not going to pass anything. And here we are 10 years later and nothing has been done. I mean, this is the fundamental flaw of Congress. And I can be critical because I was there. They can't get out of their own way. They can't see the forest for the trees. Everybody's worried about who's in charge. If commerce does this instead of FAA, then that committee in Congress is going to have jurisdiction. We won't have jurisdiction. And these are very petty arguments that are not looking at the big picture because people are too interested in themselves. And I think it needs to end and we need to move forward. But I also think it's important to note that we see a lot of the U.S. government planning for a massive conflict with China, which is the right thing to do. But it is not a guarantee that that war will occur, and we have to do the things that are necessary to make sure it never happens. And there's a lot that we can do there. And I think sometimes the U.S. government is extraordinarily short-sighted on what the opportunity space there is. We need engagement at all levels on both the civil and the military side. And we need engagement at the political level and of course at the executive level. I think that war is we can avoid it. I think we've got to do the right things. And I think it's going to require engagement that is diplomatic in nature. And I think NASA could play a significant role in that. I think right now we are, I say we, NASA is prohibited in playing that role by the Wolf Amendment, which I think is a challenge right now. NASA was formed as an institution of diplomacy. It was intentionally kept by President Eisenhower. It was kept separate from the military-industrial complex. His words, he did not want it to be part of the Department of the Army or what is now the Department of Defense. He wanted it to be an independent agency for science, exploration, discovery, and diplomacy. That's what it is. And if NASA is used as that instrument of diplomacy, I think there's a lot that could be done in the space realm to build confidence and avert an eventual war with China.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what that potentially might look like and what are the pros and cons? And also, like, how do you decide, you know, how do you personally weigh the relative value of what can be gained through any level of cooperation versus the whole, you know, basic premise of economic competition, you know, in the domain itself and the overall strategic competition for what you've already articulated might be vast and important economic value and technology that may ultimately decide, you know, terrestrial war as well as access within the domain.
You know, there's a couple of things. I think we look at history, we look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. President Kennedy did not have any direct relationship with Khrushchev at the time, with the Soviet Union. And so that presented a massive challenge in how the two countries were communicating with each other, launching shots across the bow, you know, doing different things that that would enable the leaders of the nations to communicate in a way that was not, it'd be much better to just pick up the phone and say, what are you doing and why? And let's not keep going this direction, which we think will lead to a nuclear exchange. Let's avoid this. That would have been a lot easier than going down this blockade route and shooting at each other. And ultimately, that crisis was averted, but man, there was a period of time there where it was really tense. We think about going forward from that, having channels of communication and open diplomacy and dialogue. We think about the collapse of the Soviet Union and the establishment. Remember, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1972, after we had landed on the moon, actually, we decided we were going to partner with the Soviets, and we created this thing called the Apollo-Soyuz program, where we were in collaboration. And we went from there to the Shuttle Mir program, where we were in collaboration, to the International Space Station. After the Soviet Union collapsed, we brought Russia into the International Space Station. Each one of these missions was an opportunity to have channels of communication and dialogue at the expert level, at the technical level, that would enable our leaders, if everything else breaks down, they're still going to be able to communicate. And so we think about NASA's role there. We think about, and by the way, that was a very effective way of creating dialogue and diplomacy and opportunity where our two countries generally had challenges. Make no mistake, the invasion of Crimea did not help. The invasion of broader Eastern Ukraine did not help. And so some of these activities are now far more strained and even, at risk than they would otherwise be. So I do think that for a long time, those were effective tools. And I would also say, I would say that we can establish those types of tools and relationships with China. But when you have the President of the United States and President Xi not talking to each other, which I know they have reestablished dialogue, but for a long time, years, they were not talking to each other. And then the generals, that the top General Li in China and Lloyd Austin in the United States, you know, they weren't talking for a long, like during the same period. Like, when leaders of nations don't talk to each other, that should be of great concern to everybody, especially when they're going down this road that looks like it's going to result in conflict. We should all want leaders talking to each other. There needs to be dialogue, constant dialogue, open communication. Their staffs need to be talking to each other. And things that we can do that enable that dialogue, I think, are very important. So I think that's where NASA plays. It's where NASA has historically played, and I think that's where NASA can play today.
So, you know, let's talk about, you know, that what that's balanced against. So certainly NASA has been, you know, a tool of U.S. public diplomacy, but it wasn't solely created for public diplomacy. I mean, it was the peacetime mode of strategic competition against the Soviet Union's, and it, you know, was designed to win a space race at the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly, you know, there are some out there, I'm certainly in that camp, that see this new economic frontier, you know, as a novel space race that will be consequential in the same way that, you know, the European race to develop the North American continent was a critical race.
Yep.
So, you know, talk to me about, you know, let's talk just big picture philosophy, right?
Yeah.
We have multiple sectors in our society. We have the private sector, we have NASA, we have the Department of Defense. Let's just keep it to those three. And if you want to talk about the private sector in the context of something like commerce, you know, that would be great. But like, what, you know, in the purpose, you know, in the context of strategic economic competition, what is the role of NASA? What is the role of the Space Force? What is the role of private industry? And at those nexus, how do they need to collaborate?
Peter, what you just framed out is the dime theory of national power: diplomatic power, information power, military power, economic power. And I think that's exactly how we need to think about this. Every element of national power needs to be brought to bear. And I'll tell you, China's bringing all their elements of national power to bear on this as well. So we need to be coming to the table with the same, at least the same kind of mindset on it. Now, you're right. 1960s, early 1970s, this was a great power competition. We were trying to prove that our economic and political system could result in better technology capability than their political and economic system. That was the framework that resulted in the space race that kind of finished with not just Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, but six total moon landings up until 1972. All that being said, I think it's important to note what that relates to is the I in dime, information power. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin communicated to the world from the surface of the moon, they were communicating that the United States of America has done this stunning achievement and that our economic and political system is superior to their economic and political system. So, you know, when I was on the Armed Services Committee in the House of Representatives, I would hear General Hyten come and testify. General Hyten, at the time, he was the commander of Air Force Space Command. And he would say, we cannot deter in the black. In other words, we need to do things that are stunning, that people can see what our capabilities are. NASA plays really strong in the I and dime. And that goes to, you know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin landing on the moon, six moon landings. And then after 1972, it was maybe a decade later, Ronald Reagan announces the Strategic Defense Initiative. And he says, we're going to create a missile defense shield so that their ICBMs will have absolutely no bearing on us. We'll be protected from any ICBMs that are going to be carrying nuclear warheads to the United States of America. Ronald Reagan made that announcement. A lot of people laughed at it, said it's not technologically achievable, it's too expensive, it can't be done. And by the way, all those people who said that were probably right. But the Soviet Union believed that it could be done. Why did they believe it could be done? Because we just, you know, a decade earlier, we had people walking on the surface of the moon. And by the way, everybody said walking on the surface of the moon couldn't be done. If you look at the polling and, you know, after the announcement that we're going to land on the moon, again, it was not a popular program. Of course, after we landed on the moon, now it's the most popular program in American history. But back when it was getting started, and when we had the Apollo 1 fire that killed three of our best astronauts, and then we had, you know, a number of other near disasters that got averted, but we lost astronauts in different ways. People were trying to cancel the program, and it was kept alive, and eventually we landed on the moon, and everybody that said it could be done was proven correct. You know, they made fun of it. They called it the Star Wars program because they were making fun of it. Ronald Reagan was like, yeah, we're going to call it the Star Wars program because it's cool. So the bottom line is, you can't deter in the black. We've got to be able to do stunning achievements that inspire America and make the rest of the world realize that we are capable of doing amazing things. And if we can do this in the clear, what is it that we're doing in the black that's going to make them not want to go to war with us? And so those are some of my thoughts on why it's important. It is information power. Information power is not just about intelligence collection. It's about demonstrating strength and greatness. And that's what our moon program was, and that's what we're still doing today in space.
So then, I mean, do you think that we, in terms of that, right? I mean, one of the things that concerns me specifically on the I side of the things is that, you know, you look at, you know, China, you know, is doing things that are equivalent, you know, to what we are doing. They're trying to get together sort of their own, you know, Artemis equivalent group of countries for their lunar, you know, base. They're trying to, you know, create this worldwide space energy corridor as part of their BRI. They're trying to get together a group of nations that are putting experiments on their space station. But they're also talking about super big, bold things that we're not doing. You know, they just passed an interim review for a megawatt class nuclear space nuclear power reactor. They've got plans to orbit, you know, this huge power beaming demo for space solar power, you know, circa 2030 in the megawatt range. You know, those aren't things that we're talking about. They're talking about a $10 trillion moon Earth economic zone and industrializing the moon at scale to build solar power satellites. Do we need to be worried on the I end of the scale that just those demonstrations are going to have an effect? And then on the other end, like, suppose those demonstrations end up working. Do we need to be worried about the economic avenues that opens up for, you know, hard economic power?
So the answer is yes. We need to be worried about it. It's also true that here's, I think, the important, there's a very clear distinction here. China is doing these things under the central planning of the Chinese Communist Party, and they're very centrally focused. Everything is central planning. The United States of America is terrible at central planning. We are never going to out centrally plan China. It's just not going to work. Because why? We've got 435 members of Congress and 100 senators, all with different ideas on what we need to be spending money on. Half of them want to spend money on things that are, you know, 30 years old because, well, it's in their interest for their constituents back at home. And by the way, we're going from government shutdown to government shutdown, and we're operating under a CR even right now, which is not helpful. So we don't have the ability to out-centrally plan, quite frankly, anyone. What we can do, where the United States of America is superior to pretty much every other country on the planet, is entrepreneurship. And so if there is an opportunity to use resources from the moon to create solar farms in space that can beam power to Earth, if that opportunity is out there, in the United States of America, somebody's going to see it, and they're going to capitalize it, and they're going to make it work. And we need to have, this is where it's important for us to have the right regulatory frameworks, where we're not fighting between, does commerce authorize and continually supervise these activities, which is required under the Outer Space Treaty, or does the FAA authorize and continually? And we're arguing over this. In the meantime, nothing's getting done. Private markets don't have certainty, and nobody's capitalizing this type of activity. I'm not saying I'm not saying beaming power to Earth from space is the thing that people need to invest in. I am saying that China is not the only country making those investments. Japan is making huge investments into that activity as well, and others. But that's one example. And I would say that what we have to do as a country is we have to make sure that our financial markets and our entrepreneurial markets, that these markets understand that if they put forth their sweat, their equity, their pain, and their burden to accomplish something that's going to be stunning and beneficial to the United States of America, that we will not get in the way of that. You know, it wasn't too long ago, Peter, where we had exactly 0% of the commercial launch market. I mean, I was in Congress. I got elected in 2012. I got sworn in 2013. We had 0% of the commercial launch market. Now we've got over 90% of the commercial launch market, primarily because of one company, SpaceX. And that, yes, the government was a huge supporter of SpaceX for commercial resupply and then commercial crew and all that. But this was driven by an entrepreneurial spirit. And now because of SpaceX, now you've got ULA with Vulcan that is now flown, and you've got Blue Origin with New Glenn that is soon to fly. So all of a sudden you're going to have these things. And yes, right now China is putting, they've got more government launches than the United States has. That's given. But this is all going to start reversing. The American entrepreneurial spirit is strong. And it is true that given our governance structures, we're not going to out centrally plan them, but in the long term, our political and economic system works really good, really good.
So, you know, let's try to get specific. So I think you've outlined exactly what is expected of the private sector and the regulatory aspect of that private sector. But then what is within this economic paradigm of growth, like, does NASA have any role to play? And if so, what is it?
Absolutely. So where NASA plays is, number one, they technology development, and not just technology development, but creating structures like, for example, the CLPS program, Commercial Lunar Payload Services to the Moon. There's a whole host of American companies that are participating in that activity. They're going to get benefits from participating, and they're going to take the technologies that they own. That's the key thing. Who owns the technology? And if they own the technology, what else can they do with it? Incentive structures matter. This is why our system is better than central planning, because if with the right entrepreneurial spirit and the right intellectual property, you can go a lot of different places, and innovation just flourishes. Now, make no mistake, our competitors around the world are going to try to steal that technology from our entrepreneurs, as they always do. It's got to be protected. There's a role for government to play there for sure. But at the end of the day, our economic system is driven by entrepreneurs that have an idea, that have a technology, that want to see something remarkable happen. And they benefit from the fruits of their labor. And I think that is what has made the United States of America the most powerful country on the planet. And if we continue to follow that philosophy, we win. If we abandon that to follow the philosophy of what we know historically hasn't worked, I don't think we will win.
And so in this same context of economic strategic competition, as opposed to war fighting, do you see a role for the Space Force?
Absolutely. Space Force. So the question is, at this point, the question has kind of reversed itself. How does the Space Force take advantage of all this commercial activity happening in space? In some cases, the Space Force needs to take a page out of NASA's book. So NASA has had a long history of helping with public-private partnerships, helping support commercial industry be successful, contingent upon they go get customers that are not NASA. And by doing so, they drive down the cost to NASA and increase the access to space. We've seen that with commercial resupply, commercial crew. Now we're seeing it with commercial space stations. We want to see it with commercial activity on the moon. The question the Space Force needs to ask is, are there models like that that they can apply? And I think we're seeing some of that right now, where the Space Force is willing to buy commercial remote sensing and imagery data. The Space Force is willing to, they're buying commercial launch. They're buying a lot of commercial capabilities that historically, they didn't have. So I think that is changing, and they will continue to do that. The reason to do that is because you get more access at a lesser cost. Not because it's propping up industry in the backyard of one congressman.
Now, you have been in the U.S. Navy, and certainly, when you gave your speech on "This Is Our Sputnik Moment," you also talked about a very naval-like protection role in the long term. So do you still see that as a fundamental long-term role of the Space Force?
Well, it's yes, without question. As long as America's economy is tied to space, which it is. So this is a risk. Like, the risk is this. Let's say China invades Taiwan and the United States of America defends Taiwan. If that event happens, and we are dependent on GPS for a whole host of capabilities, and China starts removing our GPS capability through maybe kinetic effects, well, GPS is how we need GPS for our power grid. We need GPS for our cell phones, for our terrestrial wireless networks. We need GPS for banking. So now they have taken what could be considered a regional tactical engagement, and now it is a strategic engagement. Because once you remove GPS, and probably some, if you start taking out imagery satellites, now you're making us, and communication satellites, you're making us deaf and blind. This becomes a strategic engagement really quickly. And so we don't want that to ever happen, because at some point you're left with the unthinkable, right? That's what we don't want to be left with. Yeah. So I think what we have to do is we have to make sure that we are investing in the things that make it impossible for them to remove GPS. Or whether it may not be GPS, it might be PNT in general, position, navigation, and timing. What are the other sources of PNT that aren't GPS, so that we don't have to take it to the next level? And these are some of the areas that I think are important. We talk about disaggregation and distributing the architecture and making it so that they can't win by taking out satellites. I mean, all that is critically important. We're not there yet. Space Development Agency and others are working on an architecture that enables that. I think we're definitely moving in the right direction on these things. It doesn't happen overnight. It's going to take time. But one area that is helpful is we do have a commercial marketplace where we can buy a lot of this capability off the shelf these days. Which is, again, a unique capability that the United States brings to the table.
So let's wrap it up by talking about where forward movement is possible. So we've got about a year left for this administration, this National Space Council, this vice president, and this NASA administrator to cement whatever legacy they're going to put forward. And then regardless of who wins the next election, we will have a new administration. So, what do you think should be on the table to move America forward? What are the innovations that needs to happen to take us to the next increment, to empower the private sector, to make sure that NASA is on track for the national goals that have been set for it? What are the big things that are occupying you at the moment?
First of all, I think General Saltzman's plan for strategic, what did he call it? Strategic, not patience, endurance. Strategic endurance. I think that's those three elements. Avoiding first mover advantage, offensive and defensive counter space responsibly, And avoiding operational surprise. I mean, those three elements, I think, as long as we're moving forward on those strategic initiatives, that is for the first time been put in place in a way that has been articulated publicly, that these are the things we need to do. And I think there's broad bipartisan support for achieving those outcomes. I think they will serve our country well. I would also say we've got to think about the value of low Earth orbit to the national economy and what technologies are going to come from microgravity and how is that going to affect our impact on the world. We're looking at a day where the International Space Station could go away and we don't have commercial space stations on orbit yet. We need Congress to step up to the plate and support commercial LEO destinations quickly, just like Congress stepped up to the plate to support commercial resupply and commercial crew for the International Space Station. That needs to happen quickly. And then, of course, we need to build this lunar architecture that includes cislunar. There is a role for the Department of Defense to play in cislunar for space. This goes back to your previous question. Cislunar, we think about the communication capability in cislunar, the remote sensing piece. We've got to have the right sensors so we have domain awareness. So between communication, navigation, and domain awareness, there's key elements to each of those in cislunar that need to be developed. And all of that would be done by the Space Force, separate from what NASA does at the Lunar Gateway and what NASA does on the surface of the moon. I think those are the key elements that we need to develop as a nation. And if we do that correctly, and whatever the next administration is, we're going to be in good shape.
Jim, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? Anything I wasn't smart enough to ask that you want to communicate as your get off the stage moment?
I would only say, Peter, that Peter, I would say that you've got it all covered, and I appreciate you having me. You've definitely covered a lot of ground in this short segment.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to share your strategic view. And thank you again for your years of service and for advancing America, both in Congress and at NASA.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.